I teach college, so it's like I have to deal with much more unruly people than y'all, and I get them going on time. We don't have that much time, so I wanted to get started kind of early, because I realized like an hour and 20 minutes for what I want to talk about and what we want to get into is really just going to allow us to skim the surface a little bit. But anyway, my name is AC Thompson. It'd be great to turn off the cell phones. I'll turn off mine. I've been an investigative reporter for most of the last 10 years. I worked for a lot of years for the San Francisco Bay Guardian. I now work for the San Francisco Weekly. They're both alternative weekly papers. Before that, I wrote for daily newspapers. I've written for glossy magazines. I've written for websites. Done a lot of different things. My specialty has become investigative reporting basically because I felt like that was the best vehicle for me to affect social change through the media. And that's what keeps me excited, is I feel like when you go up and you excavate buried truths, when you are an archaeologist of hidden information, that a lot of times you can end up changing people's lives, changing systems, changing a little piece of society. And that's what is exciting to me, and that's why I love to talk about this subject, and that's why I'm a geek. And hopefully this will be really fun and we can talk about it and talk about the things, the stories that you want to do that can affect social change. So I wanted to sort of do a little intro, talk about like five or six stories and how they got done and how to do them, and then sort of collectively workshop a bunch of other story ideas that people have. So if you have story ideas, I'd love to know this. I'd love to do this story. This is something that intrigues me. Hold on to those, and we'll discuss them towards the end of the program. When I say, like, affect social change, this is the kind of thing that I mean, is in the year 2000, I got a tip about two gentlemen who were serving life sentences for a murder that they supposedly didn't commit. And I spent 6 months researching the case, and I interviewed almost everybody involved in this homicide and in this alleged wrongful conviction. And eventually, after 3 years and after six stories that I did, the two men were exonerated. They were released from prison after spending more than 13 years in prison and were returned to the semi-free world that we all live in. And right now, they are currently suing the former chief of police in my town, who was one of the key people that wrongly put them in prison, and the prosecutor who put them in prison as well. So that's just sort of what I mean, that the sort of power that investigative reporting has. And when I did those stories in 2000 through 2003, you know, when I started out, I didn't have that many investigative skills. They were the stories that helped teach me how to do this work. And that's the thing that I want to point out here, is that you read these stories, the great investigative stories that you see, sometimes they come in the alternative press, sometimes they're in the New York Times or the Washington Post, and you're like, how the fuck did that person do that story? Do you ever read like a big investigative scoop and you're like, how did that person find that out? And I want to demystify that process, because when I did those stories that got the dudes out of prison, and it was like I wrote an 8,000 word expose, a lawyer saw the story, a lawyer took the case pro bono, took it even further, and got them exonerated. So that was my role in getting these men free. I was just like this punk rock guy who was riding around on my BMX bike listening to death metal on my headphones. You know, I wasn't Seymour Hersh. I wasn't Bob Woodward. I wasn't Dana Priest. I wasn't a super expert on investigating. And now in the years since, I've become more of an expert. But these tools that I'm going to talk about today are simple. They're really not that hard. It's not that, like, shouldn't be shrouded in an aura of mysticism or like something that's hard to do. It's easy to do. And I also want to say that even if you are not an investigative reporter, who here is a journalist or a writer? Even if you don't stick with investigative reporting all the time, or even if you eventually get out of journalism or media and go into art or activism or whatever, these are great skills to have for whatever it is you want to do. So that's my pitch on that, is that it's not, one, it's simple, and two, that these are just hugely useful skills. And on the simple tip, one thing that's important to realize, and I think this helps demystify again, is that almost all investigative stories fall into two categories. They're comprised of two categories of information. There are human sources in those stories, and there's paper sources in those stories. And once you realize that it's a binary, that really there's only two kinds of info that go into a great investigative story, it makes your life much easier. And you realize that the universe of info that you're going to have to go out and collect data from isn't really that large, and it's pretty easy to break down. It makes things more manageable. So I want to talk about how you sort of combine the human sources and the paper sources and weave together a narrative that people are going to want to read and that's going to basically expose injustice and expose something that's fucked up, hopefully. And when I say paper sources, what I mean is this, is, look, big problem that I have with a lot of journalists now, bloggers now, indie media heads now, and this goes for, like, people that I've interviewed for jobs and stuff, is that they think that you can do journalism by being on the telephone and being on the internet. And I actually think that that's the wrong approach. The internet's an incredibly powerful tool, and there's a ton that you can do with it. But I think to do great investigative journalism, you need to move beyond that sort of paradigm, the phone and your laptop. And the weird thing is that this really is a data-driven society. This really is an information society, whatever cliche you want to use. And there are huge, vast troves of information on pieces of fucking paper in musty, dusty government file cabinets all over the country. And nobody ever goes to look at those files. Nobody ever goes and actually looks at those pieces of paper. And that's what I mean when I say paper sources. That this information gets overlooked all the time, and a lot of it is not going to be digitized anytime soon. A lot of it is actually does get digitized, but never gets put on the World Wide Web, so you never know that it's there unless you start asking for it. But to start thinking in sort of old school journalism terms that there's information out there, people are collecting it, how do I go find it? That's what we're going to do today, and that's like a key thing to really go beyond the web. The thing about us as individuals and about corporations is that typically we don't want to give out information. Like, I give out information because I teach college and I'm a journalist and I end up blabbing a lot, but most of us don't just like freely hand out information about ourselves. And if we're powerful people, a lot of times we're going to do that even less, right? We want to be kind of secretive about ourselves. We're not going to try to like put everything on Front Street, right? Corporations, it's the same way. Whatever they can get away with not talking about, they're going to get away with not talking about. So the place that you learn a lot about individuals and corporations is where they interface with the public sector, with government. And the weird thing is that actually happens way more than you think. It happens way, way, way more than you think. And that's a great way to get information about both individuals and corporations. So let me give you an example. And this is an example I stole from a guy named Willie Stern, who's a great investigative reporter. He worked for the business magazines in New York and then for the Nashville Scene, which is an alt-weekly in Tennessee. And when he was working for the business magazines, he would have his job was this. Now, trip off of this job. Each week on Monday, he would get five names, and his boss would say, these are five very wealthy people. On Friday, I want to know what their wealth is. I want to know what their net worth is, and I want you to find that out between now and then. And did Willie say, dude, I can't do that, or wow, that's going to be really hard, or these guys are secretive and like weird and they're not going to tell me that? No, he didn't do that, because he actually kept this job for a number of years. He said his attitude was like, yeah, you always get the story. You never say you can't get the story, and let's go do this. So will do this. If you wanted to know how much money I was worth, we'll use an example, how would you go about doing that?
Go. I would find out where you worked, and then I would call them and say that I was interested in applying for a job. And
that's great.
And what
happens if I say I'm the exec, say, okay, so I worked at the SF Weekly for now, and I worked at the Guardian for years. You could call both of those places. You can figure that out pretty easily. What if the bosses there say, oh, we're not hiring? What do you say then?
No,
what's that? Daniel?
Did you look at the tax records?
No. We're going to come to that in a minute. What I would say to the editor, if you're trying to figure out what I'm worth, is say, hey, I'm doing a story, and I'm trying to find out basically what people make in your business, what people make at your paper. And I know you're not going to give me a specific number of what you're paying Thompson, but could you give me like a broad range of what you pay staff writers? And people are more amenable to that. There's another place that you could go for information broadly and get you into broad categories about what people who write for weekly papers make.
990s?
No, not 990s. We're going to talk about taxes in just a minute. Say what?
The Writers Union?
The Writers Union? That's good, except most people who write for publications and are staff writers are not members of the Writers Union. Alternative weeklies have a press associate. We have an association, a trade association. We have a president of our association. His name's Richard Carpell. You can call him in D.C. and say, hey, generally, what do alternative weeklies pay their staff writers in big cities? You know, I don't want an exact number, but can you ballpark it for me? You're the guy who's the president of this trade association. There's 130 weekly papers. You know, what's the ballpark? Daniel and Aaron both suggested taxes. Daniel said, what about tax returns? And Aaron said, what about 990s? Now, 990s are the tax returns for nonprofit organizations, but I work for a for-profit organization, so that's no good. And then the other one, personal tax returns are not public record. They are not widely available, so that's out. But there are public documents. There are paper documents that you could look at to figure out what I'm worth. Anybody got any ideas on those? Credit report? Now, why is that going to be public?
Well, I'm not sure if it's public, but I feel like if I were, for example, a landlord and wanted to get a background on someone, mm-hmm. I would pay for a report, and it probably would contain some of that information.
Yeah, credit reports are good, but they're hard to get if you are not a landlord and if you're not me. So what other public records can you check? That's good. I like the property one. That's one of the things I was driving at. Property records are public records in every county, in every state in the United States. And you can go to your town hall, to your city hall, and look up property records. And you can find out if I own property. And if I own property, it's going to say what I paid for it. It's going to say what it was assessed at. And it's going to tell you what the address is, so you can figure out if it's a rental property, if I own lots of property. Like, what if I own 6 buildings? It says that in the assessments. It says what I paid for them. You can go to those buildings and interview the people there and get a sense of what they're paying in rent.
You can look that up by name at the city.
Now, it varies from city to city, but typically you can look up property, you can search property records by names. And you can also search them by addresses.
And it's on the internet in some cities, too.
And it's on the internet in some cities. Yeah, that's a great point. So that's an excellent, excellent point. Another thing that I would look at if I was trying to background myself, which is a little weird, is DMV records. A lot of DMV records in a lot of states are available in a special program to journalists. That you have to make a request as a journalist to have access to DMV files. And when you have access to those records, one thing that they'll tell you is what kind of car I own, what year it is. And that'll tell you something about my worth as well, right? Like if I have a very expensive car, perhaps I'm making more money and I'm worth more money. And that'll help. What would be another public source of information that we could look at to figure out how much money I'm making? And believe me, it's nothing, but this is all theoretical.
Can you look at stock ownership?
Ah, that's good. That's good. I'll come to you in just a sec. Stock ownership, that's really good. Now, if I'm an average stockholder, if I'm just like Joe Schmo, like shithead stock owner, then like you can't look me up. You can't like find through the federal government how much stock I own. However, if I'm the director of a company, if I'm an executive at a company, that is going to be listed with the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission. And how many shares of stock I own in that company is going to be listed as well at any given time. If you go to the SEC's website, you can put that, you can put a name in there, you can put a corporation name in there, and you can get that information. And you can make a calculation right there. Okay, so if it shows that I have 1 million shares of stock in this company in which I am also the executive vice president, and the stock is trading at this amount today, then I own, you know, $1.4 million worth of stock in this company. That's going to tell you something. Yeah, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the people that regulate all the publicly traded stock market companies. So that's a... Daniel?
Well, so you're saying, how do they exactly differentiate who is a sort of big stockholder and who?
Yeah. So here's the deal. The SEC only charts the stock ownership of people who are executives and board members of companies. So I would have to be an executive of or a board member of the company, and it'll be charted by the SEC, and it'll also typically be on the company's website. Go ahead.
They tell you just for that company?
They tell you just for that company. And the point is so that you can understand, okay, well, if A.C. Thompson is the president of Dirtbag Industries and he's just sold off all of his shares in the company, well, perhaps you, the investor, would also want to sell your shares because the company is going to... That's the idea.
Did it tell you that you sold it?
Or? Yeah, it'll tell you that you sold it. And they're marked in the SEC website and on the company websites as insider trading reports. Another place that's related that you're going to get information about what a person is worth is by finding out if they are the owner or an executive at a company that maybe isn't traded on the stock market. So maybe a smaller company that's not traded on the New York Stock Exchange, but is still a decent-sized company. Now, where would you find that out about me? Come on, people. Who said it? Hand up. That's correct. Every corporations are chartered on a state-by-state basis. Every state has a Secretary of State's office, and the Secretary of State's office, either through a website or through you making a request to them, can tell you whether I am a director or an executive or a founding member of any company chartered in that state. And so that'll give you more information about whether I'm worth any money. If I'm like an executive at 6 different companies that are all currently active, then you can assume that I have some money coming in, right? In the green? That's great. That's definitely good as well. Is am I making contributions to political campaigns? Now, where would you look that up?
You can look at, like, there's a number, like, I think isn't it also the SEC? It's like, well, I know that I found it online before.
Okay. So, political donations are done at they're monitored at the state level and also at the federal level. So, if you're making federal campaign contributions, the Federal Elections Commission, FEC.gov, charts that. Most states and a lot of counties also do too. And that's going to be, you're going to check in with your local Department of Elections or with your Secretary of State, who typically also, in addition to chartering corporations, run elections in most states. So those...
Can we go back to something you said?
Yeah,
said,
yeah.
For this part of the DMV, at least in my notes, I have the DMV records.
In most states, not all states, they are. And it's not like they're up online and you can search them. And it's not like it's totally easy to get. But most states, if you are a credentialed press member, and if you can prove, like, I'm a writer for this paper or I'm a reporter for this radio station, they will give you an account that allows you to access DMV data.
For the general public.
For everyone that drives a car in that state and has a driver's license. Yeah. So that's like a great source of information, and not a lot of people take advantage of it. I'm going to talk about sort of one more way that you can find out information through public records about me and learn how much money I'm worth. In celebrity gossip columns, where do we always find out about how much money people are worth? How do they get that information? Celebrity cases.
Divorce.
Yeah, divorce proceedings. Divorce proceedings. So, how do you find out about divorce proceedings?
Civil court.
Civil court, exactly. And it doesn't just have to be divorce proceedings. So we could start and say, okay, maybe I divorced my wife. She thought I was a jerk. She made a filing, and I made a filing saying I'm worth this much, and she said I want that much. That would be in a divorce proceeding. So you go to the county court, and you search my name and see what comes up. But let's say that I actually do own these six companies and I am pulling in all this money, and along with pulling in all this money, I'm not necessarily treating people very well. So one of my employees has sued me for being an asshole. The lawsuit would probably have information about how much I was worth as well. That's another place. If I get sued civilly for any number of things, there's a good chance that in the court file will be information about how much my company is worth or how much I'm worth personally.
How much do you have to sift through to find that?
That is not the question to ask. That's not the question to ask. How to do things as easily as possible, that's not the question to ask. Because you know why? Because here's the truth. This is really the truth. Is that it's not that hard, but sometimes this work is time consuming. Going sifting through court files, that can take some time. And the information that you always want, and this is always true, is on page 1084 of the documents that you're looking through. That's true. So, yeah, a lot of times this will take time. Anybody else have any ideas about how to get information through public records on my personal wealth?
I spoke it a lot, but I would research your family. Like, I would do all of this to your family, because, like, and see if any of them died recently. Wonder and probably see where you are in the family.
And if one of my relatives died recently, what sort of public record might there be about their death that would talk about money?
Well, like, when there's a death, like, there's because of the estate stuff, like, there would be a record probably of either the will might be public potentially. I'm not sure. Where would it be? Obituaries, maybe. Yeah.
But where in public records, in, say, court files, might there be information about money I'd be getting? Go ahead. The will is not necessarily public record, but if there's a dispute in probate court about where all the heirs to a rich person dying, say my dad was rich, which isn't true, and he died, croaked, left me and my brother money. My brother, the asshole lawyer, and I got in an argument about who was going to get all the money. That would be filed in probate court, and it would say how much money my dad left, how the will was in dispute, how I called my brother an asshole, which wasn't nice, and how he said he tried to cut me out of the will because he was a lawyer. And that would all be laid out there. So some more information about how much money I came from and how much money I might be coming into is in probate court information as well. So that's great. People are on top of this stuff. It's excellent. Let's talk about a couple more. In the red? That's a... You know, I actually thought about mentioning that. Bankruptcy court filings are indeed public, and you can get more information. But if there's bankruptcy court filings, it would just tell you how much money I didn't have, you know.
One, it tells you who you owe money
to. It would tell me who, yeah. And that's,
it would tell you how much properties you own are worth.
Exactly. So, yeah, that's a good source. In the black?
Another way, not as public, but you can get a free membership. You can get a free membership to a website called hoovers.com.
Mm. There's two companies that collect corporate data, two primary companies in America that collect corporate data. And one is called Hoover's, and the other is called Dun & Bradstreet. And both of them have information about people who run different corporations. Now, if I didn't run a corporation, I'm not going to be in there. But if I am an executive corporation, the corporation and probably information about me will be in there. Now, it's spotty. It's not always like perfect, like my salary will be in there. But sometimes it is. And sometimes people's home phone numbers show up in that data, which is useful. Yeah, you know, I would be careful about not being straight up with people about what you're doing. I don't think it's a good practice to call people under false pretenses, because I think it can often get you in more trouble than it can be beneficial to you for. And also, it's like, has a way of messing with your career. For example, there was a guy who did a great story about the Chiquita Banana Company. And one of the things that he got was he basically stole the code to their voicemail and found all these amazing things in their voicemail. The story was great. The story was amazing. It was basically like Chiquita Banana fucks over its workers in Central America. But because the company figured out that he'd stolen this voicemail code and gotten it under false pretenses, he got fired from his job, and the company retracted the whole story and the whole series. And so all anybody remembers now is that this asshole reporter stole the voicemail code to Chiquita Banana. They don't remember that Chiquita Banana totally screwed over all these workers in Central America. So I'd just be careful about false pretenses.
Can you spell the name of the second company?
It's Dun, D-U-N, and Bradstreet, B-R-A-D, Street.
Hoover's is just H-O-O-V-E-R-S?
Like a vacuum with a S, yeah. So let's talk about a couple more of these. This is a true story. A couple months ago, the state of California put out an audit about accidents on the job sites on bridge jobs that were going on in Northern California. I live in San Francisco, so we have a lot of bridges because we're on a peninsula, right? And the state audited the construction companies that were working on the many bridges in my area. And they found that a lot of people were falling off the bridges while they were working on them, or they were getting limbs cut off while they were working on them, or they were getting very seriously injured while working on them. And so this showed up as a small, tiny story in the daily newspapers. And nobody really paid any attention to it after that. And it just said, state auditors figure out that a lot of people are getting hurt while either building new bridges or retrofitting old bridges. Wow. What would you want to do if you wanted to follow up on that story and like really figure out what was going on and why working people were getting hurt and killed while doing their jobs? How would you follow up on that?
Get the document itself, the audit.
That's the first thing you do, is you get the audit from the state. And the audit from the state probably has more detail than you would get in the newspaper report. Like, it's like Deepa was talking about in the immigration workshop. It's all this stuff that didn't go into the immigration stories that was actually in the immigration bills. So get that and find out who the companies are that are working on these bridges.
How did they get the
audit was publicly released by the state auditor.
Do you have to FOIA that, or does it
be? You know what? If the audit gets released to the media organizations, I bet you if you call the state auditor and say, hey, I'd really like to get a copy of this. The Chronicle had it, the New York Times had it, I'd love to get a copy of it. It's probably easy to get. Just a phone call. I'll bet you we'll do it. So you make that phone call, get the audit, find out what bridges in particular people are getting hurt on, what companies are working there, and then what would you want to do next? In the back?
Doesn't OSHA have to investigate every time a worker dies? Doesn't OSHA have to?
There you go. That's the next thing that I would do, is I would say, okay, now I know the companies that are involved. I know which bridges people are getting hurt while working on or killed on. I would go to OSHA, which is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and I would say, hey, OSHA, I want to review all the files you have for worker injuries and worker deaths that you've investigated on this bridge, this work site involving this company. And to do that, you need to make a public records request. You need to fill out a formal request that says, under state law or under federal law, I would like to review this information. And the way I would suggest going about this is, in California, it's actually Cal-OSHA, which is an agency that's deputized by the federal government to enforce federal and state worker safety laws. And so I would make it, in my state, I would make it under California records laws, and I'd say, pursuant to the California Public Records Act, I would like to review all your files on Company X on the San Rafael Bridge and all the accidents and injuries that have been there. And I would say, rather than saying, can you make me copies of all the files, I'd first say, can I review them? And I would go to the OSHA office, and I would look through these files. And again, it's going to be a lot of paperwork, and it's going to be paper. It's not going to be anything digital. And when I was looking through this stuff, I would find a lot of amazing information. And this is true. If you were going to look through those files right now, you would find that one of the workers on the bridge had an incredibly high lead content in his body because he was sandblasting the bridge, the lead paint off of the bridge, without any safety gear on. And that's illegal. No company should let its workers do that. It's illegal. And that would be in there. And you would find that he died possibly as a result of having vast amounts of lead in his blood. And you would say, that's horrifying and creepy. And you know what else? You would also know this worker's name now, because that would be in the file. You would know who his next of kin is, because that would be in the file. You would know if his family was suing, because that would be in the file. You would know who the investigator on the case was, because that would be in the file. And that would give you a whole lot of new leads to follow up on this story. You might also find out about the worker, this is true too, who cut his hand off with the power saw because he wasn't properly secured to the bridge. And you could do the same thing. You could find out his name, call him up, go see him, and say, how is life without a hand? Do you feel like you probably should have had safety gear that secured you to the bridge? You could call up the worker whose scaffolding collapsed and say, does it suck that you broke your back because your scaffolding collapsed? Are you unhappy with the company? This is the kind of stuff that you can do once you get into the OSHA files, because it opens everything up for you. It's like a trove of information. Jen?
How specific does cause of death or injuries get in those files? Would you have to then try and track down medical records?
You know, it's pretty specific. A lot of times, if somebody dies, you'll end up finding the coroner's report in the OSHA file. So it's pretty damn good. And I'll tell you one story that was done like this. The story that won the Pulitzer Prize a couple years ago for the New York Times was all about people getting hurt and killed on the job while working in a pipe factory for a company called McWane Pipe. And one of the ways that they pieced the story together, and it was amazing, was by looking through these OSHA files. So it's just a great example of how to check out if companies are really screwing over workers in your area. In the green?
Okay, my name's Hannah also.
Okay. I can't read that. That's...
It's too far away.
Yeah.
Green is pretty cool.
But, okay.
Basically, so what if you're investigating a story where it's been totally covered, basically? You've covered extremely superficially. Mm. So let's say that the story you're talking about, all these workers have gotten 10 calls already. How do you distinguish yourself to be able to, first of all, be really respectful of these people who've been giving of themselves to all these other reporters and potentially been fucked over by these stories if they're, pro-corporate reporters, in order to, really be honest with them about what you're trying to do? I'm always really concerned about that.
I've interviewed 50 or 60 people whose loved ones have been killed in terrible ways, murdered, on-the-job accidents, killed by the cops, stuff like that, drug overdoses, and it sucks. It's never a great thing to call up somebody who's grieving and talk to them about the worst shit that's ever happened to them. However, I think that most of the time you would be surprised that people want to talk about their lives, and they want to talk about what happened to their loved ones or their relatives. And I think if you call and you're gentle, and you don't have to be overly ridiculously saccharine and sympathetic, but if you say, look, I'm interested in this story because it seems like a terrible thing happened here. And anytime you get a chance to talk to me about it, I'd love to come out and meet you and talk to you about it face to face. That's what I would do. And that's what I do. And I think that is surprisingly effective. And then, you know, without feeling totally beholden to that source who's been through something terrible, you do need to, when you write the story, try to be as respectful as possible, you know. So that's good. That's a good question. I think, hold on one sec. Let's go through one more example, and then, or let's do two more examples, and then let's spend like the last 20 minutes sort of brainstorming ideas that people have here. Here's one. This was a great story. The Philadelphia Inquirer in 2003 did some great stories about nickel rides. Is there anybody here from Philly? Hannah's from Philly. We got Philly people here. Does anybody know what nickel rides are? That's when the police throw you in the back of a police van without seatbelts on, and they drive all crazy when they're taking you to the station, so you get knocked around, and you get messed up, and you bang your head and stuff. And the way I think this story came about is the Inquirer reporters got a tip from somebody who was like, I was in this police van. The police were obviously intentionally trying to hurt me. I got messed up. I smashed my head. And it really sucks. But what they did was, rather than just profiling one person that this happened to, they said, is there a broader story here? Is there a bigger picture here that we can look at? And they went to the court files, and they went through the court files, and they searched for Philadelphia police. And when they searched through for Philadelphia police, they pulled all the cases in the last 5 years involving the Philadelphia police where they had been sued by people who were angry with them. And after they got all those cases, they started sorting through them and finding, well, how many people were angry because they'd been the victims of these crazy police truck rides, these nickel rides? They found that there was a lot of people, that they had paid out like $3 million to people that they'd injured in just 5 years in the back of police wagons. And a lot of it wasn't just bumping their heads, because the injuries were totally described in the court files. The people who were hurt, their names were in the court files. The dates of the incidents were in the court files. The lawyers for the people who were hurt were there. So the skeleton of the whole story was there. And the kind of injuries that they documented was, on multiple occasions, people being paralyzed, because they would step into the police wagon, getting arrested for some bullshit thing, and they would be fine. The drivers would drive all crazy, trying to hurt them and harass them, and they'd be thrown around so violently that they would break their necks and be paralyzed because they're handcuffed while this is going on. And that was really offensive to people in Philadelphia. And the fact that the police had, it was clear from the lawsuits, never done anything to stop this, that they were willing to just keep paying out money, that they hadn't disciplined any of the people that this happened to, was all clear from the lawsuits. And all the reporters had to do was staple together the lawsuits and sort of create a mosaic of abuse of human beings and go interview those human beings and their lawyers. And it was a huge story. And when it came out, the Philadelphia Police Department, which has very little shame, was actually shamed for once. And they actually said, oh, we'll start doing some stuff like putting seatbelts in the van and disciplining people that do this. And that's the kind of thing that you can do with investigative reporting. And it takes going beyond the one sad case study that's fucked up and really sketching the broader pattern. Because if they had just stuck with one person, it really wouldn't have had that kind of impact. The police could have written it off as, oh, well, this was an aberration. This was, you know, an accident. But when you find 10 people that this has happened to and millions of dollars in lawsuits, it's clear that the top brass know this is going on. Any question on that? Thought on that? That's an awesome question. I should probably go into that. Yeah, and I was going to come to that a little bit more at the end, but let's just do it now. So like earlier I was saying about public records, and let me hit a little bit more on that. For just generally, if you want a government memo, if you want the OSHA file, if you want information about health inspections that your city's doing, whatever, there's a bunch of different laws that govern. Local governments in most states and state governments are governed by state-level public records law. And if you do a Google search for public records law for your particular state, the information on how to file a request under that law will come up. And typically, it's a one-page letter that says, hey, pursuant to my right under the State Public Records Act, I'm asking you to either let me review or to copy these government documents for me. And it's really simple. If it's a federal government document, you want to use the Freedom of Information Act. And if you put FOIA in Google, a million resources will come up. And that's the same thing. It's the federal law that governs government documents. And basically, filing a FOIA request just means writing a letter that says, hey, pursuant to the Federal Freedom of Information Act, I would like to have a copy of or review this federal document. Now, in both cases, the front-end work is really to find out who at the either local, state, or federal agency you need to send it to, and to craft your request in such a way that it's vague enough that you get what you want, and it's also not so vague and so broad that the government agency can say, look, you just requested every document we've generated in the last 20 years. We can't give that to you. So, you know, typical verbiage you're going to use is, with OSHA, it's real simple. I want inspection reports and investigation reports on injuries and deaths that occurred on this bridge during this time span. Other times, you're going to need to be a little bit broader and say, okay, I'm asking for all the audits and reports and investigations on this subject, or I'm asking for any memos or emails or reports written on this subject. So sometimes you're going to, you know, you want to craft it carefully and figure out who exactly you want to get it to. And sometimes the easiest thing to do is to call the government agency and say, hey, say to the public relations person, I'm interested in this subject. I believe that you keep records on this particular issue. Can you tell me what exactly the names of the records are so I can make a request and actually get them and save you and I time? I did that when I wanted to know about ambulance service in my city, because ambulance service in most states is overseen by a state emergency medical agency, and they have to come inspect the ambulances once a year. And what you find out from these inspections is that a lot of the ambulance drivers and paramedics aren't filling out the proper medical paperwork when they're picking people up, and they should probably do that. To get those reports, I just called the state emergency medical agency, and I said, hey, what kind of investigations and inspections do you do of my local ambulance service? And so I asked for that. Court records. Court records are the easiest things to get in the world. They're awesome. You can learn so much from court records. And to get court records, typically, it varies from county to county, state by state, and in the federal system. But typically, the easiest thing to do is to go to the courthouse and use the public computer terminals that they have there to search by party name, to search by the person who's a party to the lawsuit. And then you can pull up the case and ask the clerk to go pull that file from the stacks for you and let you review it and copy it. In the back? Say what?
How do you know which court to go to?
That's an awesome question. How do you know which court to go to? Well, here's the thing. State law is imposed in your local county court, and also it goes up the state court chain up to the state Supreme Court. Federal law is obviously imposed in federal district court, and that goes up the chain to the U.S. Supreme Court. A lot of lawsuits could be filed in either federal or state court. Say we were looking at the Nickel Ride story in Philadelphia, people who'd been abused by the cops. They could have filed in their local county court, which enforces state law under state civil rights laws, or they could have filed the case in federal court under federal civil rights law. So the answer to that question is, a lot of times it's good to check both court systems for information.
Just Hannah? Something in Philly that's particularly true there's so much public coverage of city council that if you need to like start by scanning like the daily, like knowing the reporter, like the Inquirer or the Daily News who does the city council beat, like you can like kind of follow out where they're going, like and read a lot more about like what's going on in the council. They pass ordinances, they pass resolutions, and so you might also be able to get leads that way if you need to like just like start with more compressed information. Like that's worked in Philly for me before anyway.
That's great. That's a great suggestion. Is this making sense to you about public records and about court filings? Does anybody have any? Go ahead.
So you said public records request. So at the federal level, that's the same as a FOIA?
A federal level, that is a FOIA. That's the U.S. Freedom of Information Act. And states call these different things. Like in New York, it's called the FOIL. The state law is called the Freedom of Information Law. In my state, it's called the California Public Records Act. So they're called different things at the state level. But you have a federal level that's FOIA for federal agencies, and then a state level law for local government and for state government.
How long is the turnaround time at either level?
That's a good question. With federal FOIA requests, it can be very long. With state and local government, I find a lot of times I can get things in a matter of days. So it, at the state and the local level, can be awesome. It can be like very, very useful tool.
Sometimes they will reject your request, though. Like in our town, we've tried to do things where they just flat out reject your request.
And you know, it's good to get acquainted with the law and see with the laws and see what the loopholes are in them and see how you can craft your requests in a way that gets around the loopholes. In the red?
Mm-hmm. You can imply that you're asking for any kind of legal advice, because like either the clerk or the court official or whatever will just like reject your request and be like, oh, we can't give advice for that.
Right. Any kind of question. I mean, typically, like court clerks are just an amazing resource that you can say to them, hey, and ask them to go pull the file for you, go get you the file, ask them if there's any related cases. Ask them if the person's come up in the database before. A lot of times they're very helpful like that. But court filings, both civil and criminal, can be amazing sources.
I heard that in criminal courts in Chicago, their cases are available on public computers, and there's professionals who do criminal background checks for a living. They're only allowed to use the computer for an hour at a time, but for their job, they have to be there like all day long. So they're really helpful to people who come up and say, like, hey, you've been using this computer for 7 hours, because otherwise, you know, if they were being jerks about it.
In a lot of towns, there's a lot of legal researchers that cluster at the courthouses and sort of figure out what's going on, and they copy documents for their law firm, or they look up and see if they basically do basic legal research. There's a lot of those kind of folks. Yeah. Now, the thing is that in most cases, you shouldn't be asking for something that's going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. You should make a fairly targeted request, and this is either at the state or the federal level, that says, basically, I'm looking for 100 pages of documents, or I'm looking for 10 pages of documents. The huge, expensive requests tend to be when people at either level ask for a massive, massive amount of information. And so the governments say, hey, that's going to cost us hours and hours and hours of staff time to pull together that information, and then it's going to cost us even more money to copy it. So you want to be careful about that. And the thing is, you can ask for, at the federal level, you can ask for expedited service because you are a journalist and you need to put that in your request. And so you can get it faster. You can also say, in addition to being a journalist, I'm not a particularly wealthy journalist, so I'm asking for a fee waiver for so I don't have to pay the full costs. And that can be done as well. And those are like the info to do that's pretty easily found on the web.
Yeah,
you know, because I do mostly state records and local government records, and most of the stuff it's going to take 2 weeks for me to get at the most. And so I typically am working on 5 or 6 stories at once and casting out nets, you know, and this stuff does take time. When you do investigative reporting, it's going to take time. But one thing to do is to have 4 or 5 stories that you're interested in. And if you think that there's a records component, to make those requests at the same time and constantly be cranking them out and then be getting stuff back in successive waves. I'm going to talk about one more story, and then I'd love to like hear what people are working on and sort of collectively think about how we can do those stories, because there's a ton of knowledge in this room. What if you got a tip about a landlord who was just a real assy landlord, and the tipster called you and said, "This guy's properties are really slummy. He doesn't maintain them. They're all run down and fucked up. He's not paying. He's summarily kicking people out of the properties. He is not returning people's security deposits. Man, he's really messed up." But your caller seems a little bit hysterical, seems a little bit sketchy, told you that they just like got wasted, and so you're like you're a little bit dubious about your source. How do you check this all out and verify the source? In the back?
County auditors keep records of every home that a person owns within the county. So I would just go on the county website and plug in the landlord's last name and see how many homes they own, and then go to those homes and talk to the people that live there and find out if they're having any problems.
That's great, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is that it'll either be the assessor or the auditor, the tax collector in your town that keeps all the property records in City Hall. So, like, first, find out how many properties the landlord owns, find out the addresses of those properties, and then start going to see those people and talking to them and seeing if more people are telling you this story, same story. You know, when you hear it from 5 or 6 people, then it becomes pretty clear that this isn't just an aberration, that it's a broader pattern. Another thing to do is to talk to the local health and housing inspectors, because those are the people who are going to go inspect the landlord's properties and see if they're infested with rats and mold and other vermin, and see if they are structurally sound. Are they collapsing? Is the toilet busted and spewing shit, which has happened in stories I've done? Is the roof collapsing? Is the foundation shifting and falling? That information is going to be documented by your local health inspectors and your local housing inspectors. And that information is public record. So you should totally go after that. That'll bolster your case again that the landlord is behaving in a shady, unscrupulous way. What else would you do to check this person out?
You're talking about to check the landlord?
Check the landlord out. Yeah.
Yeah,
look for lawsuits. And one kind of lawsuit that you're going to want to look for that'll tell you if the landlord has a lot of acrimony with his or her tenants is unlawful detainer cases. And when you're looking at a landlord, that's what's going to come up the most. And that means eviction cases, because they all have to go through courts. The other thing you want to look for, though, is suits where tenants are suing the landlord. And they're saying, hey, the house is uninhabitable. Or, hey, you didn't fix the plumbing for 6 months, or hey, you never gave me my security deposit back. And like, what you'll find is there are some amazing landlords out there. I got this tip. This is a tip that I got. And I followed it up, and I found that the landlord in question owned $47 million worth of property, and he really loved litigation, and that he had been involved in 300 civil suits in less than 10 years. And that there were 20 or 25 people on record in the court file who said, this landlord never gave me my security deposit back when I moved out. And they had amazing proof, like the bills from the cleaning companies that cleaned up the properties and restored them to perfect condition before they moved out, yet they still didn't get their deposits back. The landlord's letters were in the court file saying, you know, I hate you. I'm never going to give you the money back. Stuff like that. So it was amazing. And The other thing that was in there that was interesting was 14 different suits that the landlord had filed against his own attorneys. That the landlord was so sue happy, the landlord was so into litigation that he would hire an attorney, the attorney would sue all of his tenants, and then after a year or so, he'd get annoyed with the attorney and sue the attorney for legal malpractice and try to squeeze him for money. It was amazing. So there's just tons of stuff. The other thing I would say is, like, in a landlord-tenant issue, and this is like any other issue, also go to the advocates and the activists and the people who are tracking the issue. So if there's tenant advocates in your town, ask them, like, what do you know about this landlord? What have you heard? Do you have any tenants that you're working with who know about this guy, who live in his buildings and are unhappy? A lot of times that's a great source. And that goes for the police stories. That goes for the environmental stories. That goes for all kinds of stories. Is also definitely use the activists as a resource. In the back?
Could you give an example of a story where you can't necessarily find so many court records or paper records and you have to talk to more people and how that's different?
Yeah. I'll give you one and I'll make it fast and then we'll spend like 15 minutes on people's story ideas. Is that cool?
Yeah.
All right. This one's going to be controversial. Some people won't like this one. And I'll get into interviewing a little bit as well here because I talked a lot about records. All right. So I got a tip from a guy in juvenile hall who worked at juvenile hall. And he said, this fucked up thing happened. This teenage kid who was 17 murdered another kid on the city bus. And it was caught on videotape, him shooting the other kid. And the fucked up thing is he was sent not to a facility for mostly disturbed kids. He was sent not to a secure facility. He wasn't sent to anything like that. He was just sent to an average group home where he was kept with kids who were runaways and foster kids. And then he escaped from there. And he just came back through our system the other day. He's now 18. On a burglary charge and a bunch of other charges. And the source says, look, I'm a black juvenile probation officer. This was a black-on-black slang. I think that black lives should be treated more seriously, that if you kill someone, you shouldn't just get sent to a non-secure group home and be allowed to run amok, that you should be impressed with the significance of taking another person's life. And he said, and the fucked up thing is it was all on video, and they still didn't even try the kid for murder. I said, that's worth following up. Now, it's a juvenile case. Juvenile case. Nothing about it is public. There is no public record about this that I can get to because juvenile proceedings are sealed. So I asked the guy, well, what is the kid's name who's now 18? He said, his name is this. And I then went to adult criminal court and put that name in the computer. And in fact, that person had been booked on burglary, giving a false name, a bunch of other stuff. I went to the court proceeding for that guy who was now 18. And in the court proceeding were two law enforcement officials in plain clothes. And this was like the first or second court proceeding. It was very early on. And it was kind of a bullshit case. It was a burglary case. It wasn't a huge case. It wasn't a homicide case. But I watched them walk out of the courtroom after the guy pled not guilty and was sent away on bail. And I said, look, you guys aren't here for a 457 penal code burglary. You don't really care about that. You care because you think that guy killed somebody and basically he got away with it and it bugs you, right? And in the hallway of the courthouse, they said, yeah, that does bug us. And that's exactly why we're here. And we don't even really know what to do, but it's just deeply offensive to us that nobody takes these cases seriously. Black on black homicide, nobody cares. And I said, well, you know what? I'm a reporter. I'm interested in this story. I would love to talk to you anonymously. And I'd love to give you a call at some point when we're not standing in the hall at the courthouse. And they gave me their numbers. And from there, I talked to people in the juvenile system. I talked to people in law enforcement. I talked to social workers. And fleshed the story out, and every single person that talked to me had to break the law to talk to me about this case because it involved a juvenile. But a lot of people felt like it was worth talking because they felt like something beyond just getting stuck in a group home, whether it was counseling, whether it was incarceration, something, and people had different ideas, should have happened with this young man before he did something terrible again. And so that was sort of the way that I worked that one. And there was almost no paper trail in it at all. So like I said, it was going to be controversial. Some people wouldn't like that story, but that was how I went about doing it.
How did your editors deal with a story that had so many anonymous sources?
They were unhappy. No, actually, they weren't unhappy because they understood why that was. And I put in the story, like, look, this story is just stuffed. It's bulging with anonymous sources. And the reason is that nobody can legally talk about this case. And my angle wasn't like lock everybody up. It was just like, let's have a more serious dialogue about what's going on with homicide in our city. And last thing I'm going to say quickly about interviewing is that the last people that I interviewed in that case, in that story, were the people who were directly responsible for how the case was adjudicated. So prosecutors and the juvenile probation departments, which are the two people that have a big influence on what happens in a juvenile crime case, because I wanted to collect all the evidence from other sources who were skeptical about how the case had been handled and understand how everything worked from their perspective and have all that information before I went to the people who I was kind of saying had not maybe done the best job and saying like, hey, did you screw up? Did you mess up on this? And so that was the order that I ordered the interviews. And a lot of times when you do investigative reporting, the target of your investigation is going to be the last person you talk to. It's not going to be the first person. If you're not going to talk to the landlord who is like screwing over all the tenants first and say, hey, before I've done any reporting, I heard that you are screwing over your tenants. You're going to go, he'll say, no, I'm not. I'm a great guy. I'm a lovely human being. You want to get all the evidence and say, hey, I found that you have 27 housing code violations, that you've sued 7 of your tenants, that you've got 13 health code violations. What do you think of that? You know, that's the way you want to order your interviews when you're interviewing for investigations. All right. Aaron, did you have a...
I was just asking about a story where you had virtually no cited sources in the story, what that looked like. So.
Yeah, it was a little weird. It was a little weird. And like I said, it was like, the thing was, in San Francisco, there's about 100 homicides a year, and only about 20% of them get solved. And the vast majority are homicides of young black men. And I felt like the system was both racist and classist in locking up young people of color all the time for bullshit drug offenses. And that was one of the things I wrote about, was you could get a lot more time for a drug offense than you could for homicide. But it was also being racist in not investigating the deaths of young people of color, and that was another way that the system was racist. And that was my angle.
When you're talking with a source off the record, are people sometimes weird about recording it? Do you have to just take hand notes, or what's the kind of protocol on that?
I never interview. I mean, I almost never use tape recorders. I always use pads. And I encourage you, as much as possible, if you're doing print, to take written notes, because for investigations and in cases where people are anonymous sources, when it's, where it's a complicated, risky situation for them to talk to you, a lot of times they feel much more comfortable talking while you're taking notes rather than you taking a tape recording, because they know that the notes are not going to end up posted as an MP3 file on the internet. They're not going to get put on a cassette and sent to somebody's boss. They're not going to fall into wrong hands. So I recommend written notes.
It's totally unethical to record somebody without them knowing, right?
It's illegal, too.
Yeah.
It's illegal in most states. So you should be aware of that.
Okay.
In most states, it's a two-party consent law when you're recording a phone conversation. That means that both parties need to know that they're being recorded in most states. Yeah, you need to tell the person that you're recording it. You need to say, hey, I'm recording this. Is that cool?
Okay.
Or say something like, I'm rolling tapes, like we'll roll tape I have a question about story ideas.
Well, let's throw out story ideas. We got like 10 minutes. I'd like to, maybe we can go a little bit longer, but let's brainstorm some story ideas. Is that what you wanted to do?
Yeah.
Good.
Detroit in the past, since September, 80 some people died because there's a cancer drug being mixed with heroin called cane. The people came called magic, they're calling it now. And it barely been compressed at all. It just now, recently, the county didn't do it because a very rich boy girl died of it.
Are people using it recreationally? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Cancer drug mixed with cocaine?
Yeah, and.
Fascinating. So what's the story idea? What do you want to, how do you want to get into it?
He's like trying to cover it, and like he's going to talk to the Seymour guy, and he's like, listen, people are junkies, so we can't get anyone to care. You know, if this was a virus, all national media would be here. So the Moore guy didn't have anything to say. Police don't want to talk to anybody. It's not really any court records really involving this yet. I mean, you can just look at the Moore records.
Right.
So I'm just like hoping to get some suggestions from here.
Yeah.
The FBI is saying maybe it's being made in Mexico. Other people say someone stole out of the hospital. At first, my idea was someone just stole it, not knowing what it was, and was using it to cut stuff.
Well, this is a great story. Now, let's ask the first question. Did your colleague pull the morgue reports, the coroner's reports?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, that's what you want to do then, is you want to get, the first thing to do is to get all the coroner's reports and see how many of these cases there are. It's in 3 weeks.
There was 49 deaths in 19 days.
Oh, my fucking God. Yeah. Well, listen.
Yeah.
It might have broke other places, but I'm saying in Detroit.
Well, here's what's going to happen is to get the toxicology back on, typically in most cities, on a coroner's report is 6 to 8 weeks. So make the request, start making the request now for that information. And that's specifically one thing that you want to get is the toxicology on it. And a good thing about when you get those records is that it's going to have the people's names, and on coroner's reports there's always a next of kin, and typically there's a phone number for the next of kin. So that's one thing that you're going to want to do. And that's kind of the first thing, right? But if this is happening very quickly and very fast, then this is a case where you're going to want to move to like street intelligence, to human sources, to like talking to people in the neighborhood and trying to find out as much as possible. And the other thing is, will the coroner, if this has hit the press, will the coroner let you know the names of the deceased? So if the coroner lets you know the names of the deceased, and these are suspected overdoses on this drug, once you have names, then you can find the addresses of the people, and then you can find their neighbors and family and talk to them about what's going on. So even before you get the coroner's reports, you might be able to get names and start following up. But this really feels like this is a human source story right now. All right, let's brainstorm.
So much the word on the street that like everyone there was talking about it. Everyone, like three people there, had OD'd themselves, and everyone knew someone that had. So it was like that was, you know, by far the easiest way. And even though that wouldn't be necessarily all the verified like factual stuff, you know, that was a lot of good to start with.
That's excellent. That's a fucking great suggestion. Totally.
If you wanted to do the paper stuff, like I would really recommend. You were just saying that you think that the cancer drug came in through Mexico.
Plus, these reports FBI.
Well, that's stuff you can check. Like you can see, like how, like has there been like an increase in like stops at the border, and like what particular border? Like do research on other stories about where drugs come in through, and like find out the domestic manufacturer of the cancer drug, because they're probably trying to do a PR campaign of their own to cover it up. And like it depends, like what's your, if you're like an activist working with this and you want a target and you want to like stop the distribution of the drug, like targeting the major corporation that profits from the distribution of this drug might be your attack.
Is there any way to like find out, like I don't know, the known manufacturers of any particular chemical? Like if I want to know who makes Agent Orange, couldn't I figure out, like, who makes Agent Orange, who makes the fentanyl?
You can look, like, GlaxoSmithKline, like, Merck, like, these, the major drug manufacturers have to, first of all, the FDA has to track them.
Right.
Like, and second of all, like, there's, again, like, lawsuits, reports, like, the whole Vioxx thing, the whole Vioxx scandal happened because of lawsuits, because of deaths. Like, you can, you have to choose your tack. Like, I really like your tack, because it's about people getting hurt and legal exchange, but it depends, if this is a national story, like, you can get the company.
Also, with the drugs, though, I mean, I actually got a letter from a cancer patient who was really outraged about the story, because he's like, you know, you're making it sound like this bad thing, but lots of people like me can only make it through life with this. I guess a painkiller, really.
Yeah, it's a narcotic.
So, so that might, I mean, for that story, I don't think the company is really the villain or whatever there, but.
It's also, I just found online, there's at least 9 clandestine factories of it that have been found in the country in, like, the last 5 years. So it's being manufactured.
Excellent. That's great. You want to move on? Should we move on to another story idea? Who's got a story idea they want to throw out? Go.
It's last year, but in my neighborhood, like a really dilapidated abandoned neighborhood in Pittsburgh, there was in a period of like 2 months, there was a bunch of arsons of really large, there were 3 fires that I feel like were suspected arson of large abandoned buildings, and no one knows why.
So how would you investigate it, folks? How would you investigate that and see if it was arson?
Find out who owns the buildings.
Yeah, first thing is look at the property records and find out who owns the buildings. Are they related, you know? What would we do after that? Ideas?
Insurance records? I don't know if that's public.
Insurance records are generally not at all public unless there's a lawsuit about you didn't cover my claim when my house burnt down, and so I'm suing the insurance company. Yeah, exactly. So when an investigation is going on by the fire department or the police or the FBI, typically you can't access that document because they say, ongoing investigation, we're not giving it out. But if they've closed those investigations, which a year later they might have, they should be able to give you the report that says, this fire was accidental, or we believe this fire is arson. And one thing you could do, and a lot of times this is sort of interpreting signals, is that if it's a year later and the cases aren't closed, from that you might be able to assume that this was an out-of-the-ordinary fire or this was an arson fire, because they would have been able to figure it out within a year whether it was or wasn't. You know, that's another thing that you can do there. Another thing you could do that'll tell you a little bit more is 911 call tape, the tapes of the calls and the computer records are legal as well. And that may give you some insight into what happened on the night of the fire. Well, you know, did the fire department not show up for 45 minutes because all the firemen were drunk? I mean, like, that stuff happens sometimes, you know. Is that why the place burnt down? You know, whatever. There may be some information there as well. Other ideas? Ryan?
I'm thinking of like the Liberty City residents in Miami who were just arrested on domestic terrorism charges and on like virtually no claims at all. And I think their only supposed Al-Qaeda connection was an FBI agent who was posing as an Al-Qaeda figure. Like in these scenarios where the FBI is like referring to this body of information that the public can't access, how do you challenge those events as they go down?
Well, you know what? Like the thing with that, and this is a good thing to think about, is that all that information is going to become public record very soon. Everything that the FBI has compiled is going to go into a court file in the next couple weeks, and it's going to be unsealed. And at that point, it's going to become a lot easier to start assessing the government's case and seeing whether it's full of holes and whether it's hysterical or whether it's actually a valid case. And that's going to be the first thing that I would do to check it out. And, you know, with that case, the FBI person wasn't actually an agent. It was an FBI asset. In other words, it was an FBI snitch informer. And I think the first thing that defense lawyers are going to start doing is trying to find everything out about the snitch informer. and seeing like how credible this person was, seeing how much of a criminal history they had themselves, seeing how much the snitch goaded the people into allegedly becoming like Al-Qaeda wannabes, you know. And I think that would be a fruitful place to look. You know, this is another case where before that information is available, it's like I would go to the neighborhood, I would talk to the families, I would talk to the friends, I would talk to the bosses and see what you can figure out as well. What suggestions do people have for Ryan on that? Come on, I know, there's like a lot of smart people here. Somebody's got a really good idea on this, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah, that's great. It's like when they get defense lawyers, the defense lawyers should be helpful to you. And it may be that you got to call the defense lawyers and say, hey, look, I know you can't talk on the record on this, but do you think it would be fruitful for me to look in this place, for example, the court file? Or do you think it would be fruitful for me to look at the snitch? Would that be useful? The other thing with big cases like that, is there's always private investigators working on the cases. And a lot of times, private investigators like to talk a lot more than lawyers do because they never get any glory or any, like, credit. And they often like to, like, talk to reporters. So that would be another source I would suggest.
How do you find a private investigator?
You know, sometimes they'll have affidavits in the case file that say, I, private inspector Sheila O'Donnell, investigated this case, and I found this witness who says everything else happened totally differently. And there'll be an affidavit or a declaration from that person. Any other story ideas?
Just one more quick thing about Ryan's case. Uh-huh. Maybe because of the charges against them, see what the military, if they have any military background, any kind of...
That's great.
You know, gun licenses, weapon training, like that kind of... Because a lot of people who, you know, Oklahoma City, you don't kind of learn really sophisticated weapons training, like, just out of the blue.
In some states, you can get information about who has a concealed weapons permit. In some states, you can't. Most gun licensing information is hard to get. The thing that you can typically get in some places is concealed weapons permits. But U.S. military records are available. So if the people went through the military, you should be able to find that out from the branch of the military they went through.
I just had a quick question about dealing with police harassment, particularly with the video. I've been trying to document crime scenes and murders in Philadelphia. Mm. And a lot of times I'll show up with my camera to a scene and CBS will be there with their camera. You know, and I'll go right next to them or, you know, on the other end. And almost always I'm asked to leave and harassed. And
I'm assuming you don't have a press credential?
No.
Are you an indie media person? Or,
yes.
And has indie media asked for press credentials from the police department?
No.
Well, you should do that. You should definitely do that. And that would be a great thing to do. And they'll give you a badge with your photo on it, your name on it. The other thing to do is state police in a lot of states issue press credentials as well, typically in case somebody gets smashed up on the highway so the like TV vultures can come photograph it. But if your local cops won't give it to you, try going to the state cops.
What do you have to do to get one?
Typically you have to send them a letter saying, like, with your information saying, like, yeah, I'm a journalist. This is my organization. You can see that it exists. This is our website. And two passport photos, typically.
Just in terms of press credentials, like, I just wanted to give a shout out because I work with a lot of low-power FM radio stations. And we have found, like, when we were trying to get into the National Association of Broadcasters Conference, which is like an $800 conference, it's closed to people, we got press credentials for all of those stations to be able to get in. And then we got people, when it was in Philadelphia, we got people in Philly to just contact those stations, like, from all over the country and be like, can I report for you? And, like, so they were, like, their stringers for those stations. And we got 20 stations into the NBC covering all the workshops and interviewing, like, the CEO of Clear Channel. So, like, there's So when you don't need like police credentialing, there's this whole network of low power FM radio stations that would be really excited to work with anyone in here and that would really want your stories. So you can obviously use the research that you want to use for whatever else you want to do too for your local stuff. So if you're interested in that, you should go to PrometheusRadio.org and I can hook you up with some stations.
Carrie?
Question, are police reports, they're not, you can't FOIA a police report, can you? Or?
Yeah, that's a great question. It varies from county to county and state to state, but typically police incident reports and the supplemental reports that go with them that document the cops coming to the scene of a crime are public record. And a lot of times they're even public record while the case is going on. That's the basic piece of information that most police departments have traditionally given out to reporters. And those can really actually be tremendously helpful because it lets you know who the police say the suspects are, who the police say the witnesses and victims are, and what the police say happened. And it also expose, if you have a couple different cops, they'll write up different supplemental reports that say, okay, I'm cop A and I saw this and this happened and then we beat the guy. And then cop B will say, oh, I saw this happen and then we didn't beat the guy. And so a lot of times they'll be really interesting documents to use. So I would go after those.
You know, because in Chicago, they almost always don't give them or they say if it's under investigation, you know, it's not public. So is there, do you think they're just like lying that it's not your right to have that? Or is it up to them to decide whether they give it to you or not?
I would check your local records law and your state records law and see exactly what the exemption is around ongoing law enforcement investigations. But I would also check and see if the Chicago Tribune is getting police incident reports and you're not getting them, for example, that they're giving them out selectively, because that's something you should challenge, you know. But definitely check the law and see if they're bending it, you know. And also, it may end up still being a useful document in a month or two down the road, you know, when they might be more willing to give it out.
The Society of Professional Journalists is in almost every state, I think.
Yeah.
And most states have an FOI chair or co-chairs.
That's great.
And
yeah.
They already know this stuff. Go to spj.org, look up chapters by state, look for them, the chairs for FOI or Sunshine, and they can probably tell you in a quick phone call or email what you should be able to get right away, what you shouldn't be able to get, and why.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea.
There was an audit done in Ohio, and it was the municipalities for freedom of information, and a lot of municipalities are political appointees, part-time employees, they don't know the law, so you really may not get what you want as easily as you think, and so to get some advice on the law quickly is a good idea. You may actually be educating the municipal employees.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. Is a lot of times they don't know the law, and if you get some advice and actually look it up, you can tell them, like, hey, like, look, this is the section that says, actually, you have to give me this government document. I'm not trying to be difficult, but, like, we should probably try to do that, you know? So it's almost 2:30, so I guess probably we got to get out here pretty soon, but is there any one last idea people want to throw out real quick? One last story idea people have?
I'd really like to see it make the national level the amount of harassment of like environmental activists and animal rights activists who are what it seems to be being railroaded at this point, that being labeled as eco-terrorists. And I'd like to see a bit of investigation into this, because a lot of the cases like Daniel McGowan, where people actually have an alibi as to where they were, it seems like it would be a perfect national story to show how this phenomenon is happening.
Yeah, I think that's definitely worth checking out. Who has ideas about the FBI's ongoing investigations of alleged ELF, ALF type people?
In Philadelphia, there was a house of people about a block away from me that was basically raided by the cops for supposed ELF work. And so, like, this is a national story, which is a little different than what you've been describing. Like, so it's, I would start, like, trying to find out as many incidents as possible and then, like, working with other people in those cities to, like, get information so you can get those personal testimonials so they can talk about how they were treated by the police. There may be a common thread in all of them, which will lead you to sort of an overarching theme. Like, it's really Department of Homeland Security laws, which are targeting everything from Quakers to environmental activists. And so, yeah, like, these personal stories have been effective in similar things to what you're describing.
I'm actually one of those people who's been targeted by the FBI for exactly that, and I think usually within the circle of people who are being targeted, there are prevailing theories that never get written about. And just having this workshop today, I can see how, you know, I could even check out things that I think are going on or not. And similarly, a journalist who had more access and more credentials to do that. So talking to people who are the victims of that harassment.
Yeah, I think that would be great. You know, and I think pulling together all the court files for the different cases and seeing what they're actually saying on paper in the court files, what the actual allegations are, who the witnesses are, who the snitches are, that kind of stuff would be edifying.
I think for this type of story too, it would be useful to look from the other end and see where this push is coming from. You know, why eco-terrorism all of a sudden? Where did that word come from? Who's introducing it? You know, who's talking about it in the Senate? You know, who's funding those people?
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. Well, hey, thank you so much. That's my email. I'd love, if you have any investigative questions, I'm a total geek, so I would love to help answer them and dialogue about your stories. And so feel free to email me. Thanks a lot.